Hello. Today is the 18th of September, and I am in Kodiak, and I am interviewing Jane Iceman. So, this one, I don't need to worry. It'll pick you up anywhere. I just
Okay.
want to get a little bit closer so I can keep my eye on it. So tell me about your relationship with the oil spill, Jane, what you were doing and what you did, because I don't know.
Well, at the time I was student teaching at the middle school. I had just was working on getting my teaching certification, and I had been fishing commercially for years, putting myself through college. And I remember that it was over Easter vacation, and it was Good Friday, and I had gone for a run with my mentor teacher, and we were on our way back into town, and we stopped to get gas. And I had the radio on, KMXT, our local public radio station. And they had just, that's when we first heard the news. It's kind of ironic. I was putting gas in the car. And I was just thinking, wow, here I am putting gas in the car. And so a lot of things went through my mind. We were getting ready to go herring fishing that year. And our herring season wasn't affected. But when we came back, we were told that in Kodiak, it was doubtful whether we would have a season or not. And so everyone was scrambling to get contracts. And it was really crazy because town just went nuts and a lot of boats got contracts. The previous year had just been a killer season. Everybody did great. And so a lot of people upgraded and with their fishing equipment and got bigger boats. And those were typically the boats that got contracts for all the various jobs that were happening, tending boom in front of the hatcheries or running people around, and they were
And what type of fishing had you been doing?
gosh, I'd done everything up to that point, but I had just gotten back from herring
Oh,
fishing,
okay.
and when we were told that we probably wouldn't get to fish salmon. So the gentleman that I was fishing with scrambled to try to get contracts as well, but there wasn't enough. The contracts he did get for cleanup effort over in Prince William Sound, he only needed one crew at a time. And so the rest of us were kind of, we were going to shift, rotate through jobs over there. And so in the meantime, here in Kodiak, I worked for a lawn care, a gentleman that provide, did maintenance for lawns and whatnot. And I remember I was down here in the mall. And I had a weed burner, and one of the contracts, the gentleman I was working with, he had a contract with the city to wash down streets and kind of keep the area clean. And one of the things was to weed burn. And there I am with my little weed burner, my propane torch. And I remember the superintendent of schools at the time, he comes up, he goes, "Jane, what are you doing here? Why aren't you out fishing?" And I just looked at him, I said, "Well, I'm paying the bills, John, and there is no fishing." And I guess he wasn't aware that our fleet was tied up for the most part, and people were scrambling to get work because at that point, Exxon had said we will make you whole, but of course there was some doubt about all of that, and it was just a crazy time because some people got contracts, some people didn't. It really split our community between the haves, the contract people, and the haves not, the contract people, and there was a lot of bitterness.
It's almost as though it was a well thought out move on the part of Exxon to divide and conquer.
Well, if that
Well,
was the case, they did a good job. But it was really interesting. After we found out about the spill, I kind of jumped ahead in history there to the herring season, which was, oh, a month later. We actually left to go out to Togiak. But in the classroom where I was working as a student teacher, we had the radio on all day long. Everybody was tuned to the radio, and it was like listening to troops. As we listened to the progress that the spill was making towards Kodiak, it was really frightening. I mean, it was you know, reports on the half hour, how far the oil had moved, and trying to speculate whether it was going to make it to Kodiak, and listening to our, you know, mayor and the different people trying to come up with a plan. What are we going to do if it does get here? And it was fascinating and scary at the same time. It's kind of like the enemy was approaching, and we were getting, you know, updates on how close the enemy was and what we're going to do. And it just kind of got worse from there. And I went, you know, when we went out to Togiak, we were keeping our listening, you know, paying attention to what was happening and how far the oil was getting. And when I came back, got back to Kodiak, I had some friends that were working on the spill, and their stories were just devastating about what they had seen. And, you know, a lot of people here got contracts to go pick up oiled animals, rescue, but mostly dead animals off the beach, and just heartbreaking photographs, which everybody has seen. You know, the images are still, even today, so long after the fact, are just, they're devastating. I show this film in my classroom. I teach maritime science and technology, and we look at the oil industry, and I try to present it in such a way that's not opinionated, but it's hard at times. But there's some images.
Oh, sorry,
that's all right.
Here we are.
Okay. Hello. Yes, we are recording. Oops. Okay, we're back on with Jane Heisman.
RIT. Okay. So anyway, there's some images and some of the footage that I show that still just brings tears to my eyes. You know, I'm a softy anyway, but yeah, it's very fresh.
Yes.
Still, after all these years.
Right.
The memories are incredibly fresh, and as we deal with the possible end of it all, the financial end of it all, what is Exxon going to do? I just want it to be over. Just let it be, let that be over, whatever way it turns out. But it will never be over. I mean, there's just going to be some lingering things with emotional lingerings and environmental lingerings, but
Stacy was telling me about how the town got together and burned the Exxon Valdez and Joe Hazelwood in effigy, and what was that shift like in the town from, I don't know, it seems like it must have gone from, I don't know, just a sense of betrayal, of trust to betrayal. I was much less cognizant of it in Homer. We weren't in any way affiliated with the fisheries. Plus, I had two very young children constantly running around, and I just, my eye was just not on what was happening. But what was that like in Kodiak?
Well, most of that, I wasn't here when they had the big rally. Mm-hmm. I was in Togiak. I can't remember. Did Stacy say what the date was of that? I've seen pictures of it. Mm-hmm. I might have already been over part of the cleanup effort in Prince William Sound at that point. So I wasn't here for that. But I do remember more of a sense of getting together as a community to do what we could to protect what we still had.
Mm-hmm.
And they were building boom out at the Coast Guard base, and they had taken over one of the hangars. And this just incredible frenzy of activity and optimism that we could protect what we had, but this incredible sadness because all of these images were coming back into town from people who had been out on, you know, on the retrieval of oiled animals, most of them dead. And there was a sense of betrayal, but honestly, you know, I have kind of a different, because I was looking at it from the fishing industry and just trying to get back out on the water and wondering how I was going to pay bills. I mean, that was kind of secondary to what was happening environmentally, but at that time they were, I mean, I had student loans I had to pay back, and here my job was taken away from me that I had put myself through school you know, but I mean, there were still loans. So I think I was just more focused on wondering if I was ever going to get to go fishing again, number one, really thinking about the reality of that. And number two, in the, you know, the near time sense of, what am I going to do this summer? Because they've already said that we can't. So anyway, I ended up getting a job. And
so you went to work on the cleanup
in Prince William Sound. The gentleman that I was fishing with, kind of a mover and a shaker, and realized if he was going to keep it together with what he needed, he was going to have to get a contract. And there was more contracts being offered, I think, in Prince William Sound. Mm. So he had many different contracts. The first crew member went over and assisted him. He had taking out people that were collecting baseline data, trying to find some baseline data, fisheries research. And then when I got there, we had a contract to deliver mail to all the different task forces in the Sound. And that was phenomenal because it was kind of being fought like a war. You know, when the oil was approaching, I felt like the enemy is approaching. And then when I went into the battleground, it was like being fought like a war with task forces and the talk on the radio. And it was fascinating listening to the radio over there because you heard there was people that didn't even speak English that were speaking patois that were from the Gulf states that were up every imaginable craft to fight this war. It was truly amazing when it all got pulled together as far as what it took for that initial cleanup.
Spell patois for me and tell me more about that.
Oh, I don't know how to spell patois. Patois. It's kind of a...
Okay, well, I'll find
out. Yeah, look it up. But it's like a Gulf kind of French...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I you're the first one who's spoken about this conglomeration of nations out there. I've never heard it...
Well, not so much nations, but... And there, people, I think people from around the United States, and I think there was a international effort for the cleanup because I think there was, and I don't know for certain, but I'm assuming that there was expertise in other parts of the world that came here, but I could be wrong on that. But boats from all over. I mean, we had the largest floating crane in the world. As this is my recollection, and I have pictures of it, and I remember tying up to one of the pontoons, I guess you would say, that, you know, they can tow this crane around. And I remember coming up to it. It was being used to house workers that were part of that task force. And this huge monstrosity of this float, you know, this floating unit. And I remember pulling up to it. It was kind of foggy, and you couldn't see the top of it. It was so far in the clouds.
Wow.
And one of the big pontoons, I guess when they tow it, they retract these pilings, I guess, and they can tow it. And then when they get on scene, they extend like a telescope down, and they fill them full of water for the ballast. And I don't know if it actually rests on the bottom. I don't know how deep it was where we were at. But this huge thing, you know, I was on a 42-foot boat, which is not a big boat, but one piling just dwarfed us. It was kind of scary tying up to this thing. And there were tugboats from everywhere and floating barges that they put connexes on, you know, to house people. And going to these places, we had a route that took us a day and a half to deliver all the mail and whatever groceries and packages and things that people wanted. And every place we pulled in, it was just so interesting because typically we would get there, some of them, at mealtime. And it was, I would go aboard, you know, aboard these places and we would be invited to eat. And the opulence of the meals that were provided for the workers was just, and the waste was phenomenal with the food, you know, steaks and prime rib and avocados and artichokes and then you'd see what they tossed out, and it was just crazy. Mangoes. And I brought this little gift box
things
over
we hunger
my
for.
Yeah. I brought this little gift box of mangoes over to the gentleman I was working for, thinking, oh, this will be a treat. And he looked at those, and then he opened up one of the places that we stored food on the boat, and it was full of all that stuff already. He said,
yeah,
we get whatever we want. But one gentleman I talked to on board one of these floating hotels to house the workers.
Now, just before you go any further, Jane, you said Connex. What is
that? Oh, it's like a...
What is that? Those abbreviation for?
Oh, I don't know what that... It's a container, like a container van,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
But you can have them so you can put windows in them, and they're like quick housing on
okay.
scene at different
okay.
places.
Okay.
You can put them on the decks of boats.
Alrighty.
And so they may have bunks
okay.
in them, and yeah, so. But I was talking to this gentleman, what is it like being part of this cleanup effort and being housed on this floating conglomeration? And he says it's a cross between being in high school and being in jail. Is that interesting?
Yes.
And you would just see all these, it was, you know, just the dynamics between everybody, because all of these people, I don't know where they got all these people to do the cleanup. I know where I came from, but some of these people were not, a lot of them weren't from Alaska. It was kind of like they just went out and got this little people magnet, and anything that stuck to the magnet, they shipped it north because they needed bodies. So you had people from all walks of life.
I've had people from people different. One gal from DEC describe it as the Woodstock of oil spills.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It was, and so you would see all of this interaction, these people that are working hard all day and being in an environment that's not especially the you know, here you are in the most beautiful place in the world, and yet what are you doing? You know, I mean, there's these, it was just, and watching from people taking those big the pom-poms and wiping rocks off, to the guys and gals that are using the high pressure hoses and breathing in all of that stuff all day long, to picking up dead animals. I mean, it just, the jobs were.
So did you get to stay on the mail crew? Was that?
We did that. It was fun. We did that for I did that for 3 weeks, and then we got a job as a water taxi in the Port of Valdez.
Mm-hmm.
I had clean jobs.
Yeah.
I was really fortunate. And then my last job, I got on a tugboat.
Well, tell me about being a water taxi. Nobody's talked about this kind of stuff before.
Well, there was vessels anchored everywhere in the front of Valdez. There was big boats that were waiting for a chance to get, you know, tugboats waiting for a chance to get next to the dock that were anchored up. There was a vessel, a floating boats, their hulls had to be cleaned before they could move from point A to point B, you know, or to leave the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had this contraption where boats could, a floating contraption where they could go and get lifted out of the water, on the water,
mm-hmm.
and sprayed off. And so there was all different kinds of vessels that were playing some role in the cleanup, that there wasn't enough place for boats to tie up.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd be anchored offshore. And so the people on board those boats would have to travel back and forth, you know, to Valdez and back out to their boat, or maybe to another boat. So we were the water taxi. And they'd call us up and, you know, we need a pickup on, it was just like being a taxi, but on the water.
Wow.
So that was really interesting.
Interesting to talk to somebody who had a relatively happy job on the oil spill.
I did.
Yeah, we know it's a crisis, but everybody played different roles,
mm-hmm.
and it's very refreshing to hear somebody who had a less than hideous experience.
It wasn't hideous. The hideous part was the emotional drain that I saw, like back to Kodiak before I left here to go over to Prince William Sound. Just the heartbreak and the haves and the have-nots again. You know, there it kind of split our community, and I think we're still experiencing that. We have in our, and I think this is a common phrase everywhere, but we have spillionaires.
Yeah.
And so many homes in our community, well, not, I don't know how many, but enough that I know the ones they are, homes were built and new boats purchased, or new gear, or moving along in the fishery, or changing gears. A lot of that was financed. It's my opinion that a lot of that was financed. I didn't see anybody's record, so this is all my opinion, but that were financed by monies that were made on the spill.
And that was very hard for people who, like I said, we just came off of a phenomenal salmon season the year before. Mm-hmm. 1988 was phenomenal. And everybody expected it to happen again. And they were banking on it. Yeah. And it didn't happen. And it has never been the same since. And so that just... So there's kind of a funny story. The gentleman I worked for had a flatbed pickup, and that we used it here in town to haul nets and stuff. You know, just it was part of his business. And I guess we were going to take the herring net off the boat, and had the flatbed. And he said, "Well, take it up to the gas station." And he goes, "Try this. When they ask for the, you know, who to charge it to," he said, "say Vico, see what happens." I did. And they said, "Thank you very much." So that flatbed, you know, fuel bill was not paid for by my skipper, and I feel guilty about that, because that's typically not my
style.
But there were people who went to the grocery store and they had a endless account, and they were filling their freezers and their friends' freezers, and it was just blatant. People just took advantage, and they felt they deserved it, and I understand that.
Right. Who's to say?
I understand that totally. So, but back to the, I always thought it'd be fun to. I saw all these people coming in from the task forces. You know, they had done their tour of duty, and they were coming into Valdez, and these people getting off these boats and getting on buses, heading them north back to Anchorage or whatever, and just a look kind of like they were shell-shocked, and some of them probably had never had that much money in their pockets ever. And here they are. They're going back to civilization with no... guidance on what to do, because they may never make this kind of money again in their whole lives. And I just felt so bad. I thought I should set up this counseling thing. Everybody has to talk to me before they go off onto their life. You know, I was worried about these people that had made all this money and had just been through this incredible experience, and how that was going to fit into the rest of their life. And I want everybody to make the right decision, because, you know, just it was such a freak thing, the money that got thrown at this spill. And another funny story. You stop me when I get going.
You're good.
We were coming out of Kachemak Bay on our way. We had just come back from Togiak. We were seeing the hustle and bustle in Homer. People were building boom. We were told we weren't going to get fish in Kodiak, where the oil was, where, you know. And so we were coming back to Kodiak. We were leaving Kachemak Bay, and I knew that there was a lot of otters, you know, didn't make it, oiled otters. And we're heading out of the bay, and up in front of us, I see this bloated, huge, I mean, he's just bloated with his paws stuck up, floating just stiff on the water. And I'm just thinking, I don't want to see this. This is going to break my heart, you know. And somebody on board said, "Well, let's go get a closer look. Let's go check it out." So we go up to it, and I'm just like, "I don't want to watch this," but I'm kind of up on the bow. And we get up to this otter, and the otter is not dead. He's sleeping, and he's so fat and so bloated, and he looks at us, and he throws his paws up in the air, and I just see these huge eyes and all these teeth and this huge scream. And then he dives. And I just about, all I wanted to do was cry and go, "Yay!" You know, because it was a happy story. This otter was okay, you know. But it was just kind of like, you know, I was expecting the worst and the best happened in that little situation.
Well, how about the kids at the middle school? What kind of reactions did you get from them?
It was so foreign, because nothing like this had ever happened. And I think they were just trying to get a grasp on why we were concerned, because it wasn't anything it wasn't in their face, because it wasn't right here at that time. I think there was a bit of fear because adults were so concerned. I don't remember any specific incidences with kids in that they wanted to know more. I mean, a lot of the kids' families were in the fishing industry, and I think we... Honestly, I can't remember.
Yes.
I just remember the radio was on the desk,
yeah,
and it was on...
That's a long time
all
ago.
All day long.
Yeah.
Yeah. But some of the kids, after I did get my teaching certification, were my students when they were... Because I teach at the high school, and I was doing my stint at the middle school. And some of the kids have gone through my class that worked with their parents on the cleanup, that the boat, you know, that they remember. Now, when I talk to my students, most of them were born the year that it happened, and they don't have any really recollection. You know, they hear stories, but it's so... It really is ancient history to them.
Yeah.
And I know some of them are... Their parents are concerned about how this is going to play out with the monies, because a lot of my students, their families are in, you know, have claims and stand to do quite well.
Right. Yes, for better or worse.
It's a scary thing, and that scares me. If it comes through and the money happens, what's going to happen to our town? It's going to be like the same thing over again,
mm-hmm,
because so many people didn't put in claims that could have, and it's just, it's going to be ugly again, and that really scares me about what's, it's just going to go on for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't come through the way people want it, there's just going to be a lot, some people have banked on it.
Yeah.
Totally. And they're leading their lives like it's going to happen, and they're in debt now. And that's scary.
Oh.
Yeah.
Boy, if when you're dealing with people like Exxon, I don't know how much I'd want to take that to the bank.
Oh, well, it's all been interesting. But this oil spill had such a silver lining for me, and if I had to live it over again, would I want it to happen? Of course not. You know, my silver lining wasn't worth the just the devastation on all levels. But I was very fortunate in that I'm always thinking ahead, and I realized that some of these contracts that people got that first summer cleaning up were very lucrative, and there was some talk about, well, next year we're going to clean up the places that need to be looked at again or move on. And there was all this talk about, but we're not hiring any skippers unless they have their Coast Guard licensed. And I kept that in the back of my mind thinking, that sounds like an opportunity. You know, what am I going to do with my life here? I can't go fishing. You know, we still didn't know whether we were going to go salmon fishing the next year.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, this could be a career move for me. I've got enough years on the water. Maybe I should get my Coast Guard license and see if next summer there's a chance at getting a contract. And so I went down to Seattle and...
Bones.
Not a problem. It's a nice cell phone ring.
Hello.
With me.
Okay.
Okay, so okay. Anyway, I'm rambling. I'm
sorry. Oh, no. Rambling is good. Rambling is good because we can always cut and paste.
Okay. Well, anyway, the next summer I did get a job running a boat. And my world just opened up. My maritime world opened up totally by getting that Coast Guard license, which if we hadn't had the spill, I wouldn't have been. Never in my mind did I think I wanted to go that way in my career. You know, I was happy just fishing as a crewman and putting myself through college, which I had done. And
So there was, it's my understanding that the cleanup ended right then and there, but there was the second summer.
We had the second summer. It wasn't a big effort.
Mm-hmm.
At least, well, I worked out of on the north end of Kodiak and then on the mainland. And really, it was so tedious. I mean, the crews would go to the beach. My job was, I just had great jobs, hauling people back and forth from the mothership to the beach, taking waste in these big bags from the beach back to the mothership so it could get to an incinerator. It was a great job for me. I don't know what the cleanup effort was in other places,
mm-hmm,
you know, as far as in the Sound. And
the folks that I worked with certainly had attitude, the folks that were part of Exxon and Vico. I got along fine with them, but it was definitely kind of us and them.
I should imagine.
And it would, anyway, but...
Yeah, I'll be interviewing some of them pretty soon here. Well, I already have. I've done some.
It was just, you know, all the people involved. It's so sad. The people that worked for, you know, that worked for Exxon, the people that worked for Vico, the people that, they were thrown into this disaster, and everybody did the best they could. And even though the mandate from wherever at times seemed to be conquer and divide, or I don't know. I think basically people were backed into corners, mm-hmm. and they just fought. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I look at interviews from back then when representatives from Exxon or from Vico would try to pacify a group of angry people, and I felt so bad for those people that were up there trying to do the pacifying, because there was really nothing they could say
right. That
could make it any better. And some things were said that in the end weren't true, like this quote, "We will make you whole." And I'm sure that that gentleman that said that truly believed that that was going to happen. Or maybe he didn't, but I think...
But he wanted to.
He wanted to. And in the end, I don't know what that is. After a disaster like that, no, it can't be. You can't. It's just beyond money. You can't repair emotions, and you can't repair a loss of an ecosystem as far as... And yeah, it's doing a lot better, but you can't fix that. And time is certainly helping on a lot of levels, but the mistakes were already made prior to that, you know, and it's just this chain of events that made, you know, that allowed that accident to happen. So I am so thankful that we had Open 90 and that we have this Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. We're vigilant 24/7, and we're still concerned that we're going to have an accident. Back then, I think we just got, well, you know, complacent is the key word, you know. I think everybody did, not just the oil companies and the transporters, but we all did. We all thought that it was being taken care of.
Right. Yeah.
And it just wasn't. And so, you know, I hope we've all kind of learned. But I see we're slipping back into the complacency on many levels in many industries in our country.
Yeah, it sounds like RCAC is just having to watchdog those guys.
Well, the thing is, it's really, it's gratifying to work with industry, even though we butt heads all the time.
And it's gratifying because...
It's gratifying because I think that we make progress. That even though the bottom line is making money for shareholders in different companies, that's what it's all about. That we can do it in... I'd like to think that everybody involved wants to do it in the safest way possible, but that money thing, you know, they don't want to pay to make it the safest way, but there's certainly the money to pay for it.
Yes,
that's my opinion.
So you're on the board of directors in, mm-hmm. what's your position?
I represent the city of Kodiak, mm-hmm. and in the past I've been on the executive committee, but I kind of took a step back this year to make time for some other things, and but I sit on various committees, on the finance committee and the
Well, there's just so many committees. You can be as involved as you want if you're in Prince William, you know, and RCAC. And it's just fascinating. It's right up my dirt road with what I teach in my classroom. And I just
you know,
love it.
The light is perfect. I'm supposed to get a photograph of it. Oh. The light is just perfect for right now for this, and it's going to change in just a minute. So just let me indulge
me. I look like such a fuddy-duddy.
Oh, come on. Perfect. Now you tell me, is that a fuddy-duddy? And did you hear?
I think it was okay.
There.
That works.
Yeah. That's good.
But I guess in conclusion, unless you had another question.
No.
Sounds like got Belika online. I guess I'm an optimist in that. As humans, we want to do the right thing and we learn from our mistakes. That's my optimistic. I'm not just talking about oil companies, but you know, the paths that we choose as a culture, as a society, what we choose to do, how we choose to run our lives, and so much of that is dependent upon practices that harm the environment with regards to our fuel addictions. I would like to think that we're going to figure this thing out so we don't have to depend on resources that the use of can demean our environment. But on the other hand, I don't think we're learning those lessons. I think we just grasp at what's next and what's cheap, and the dollar plays such an important role in the whole thing. And so I would like to think we won't have another accident, but I don't know.
Well, optimism is good, that's for sure. We need more of it.
Yeah.
Getting bogged down in all of the heartache. I don't know. I don't know how much that's done anybody very much good.
No.
I know. I have about 20 pens in here. But I have your photograph. I need to get your consent. There you go. And once I get this transcribed and edited, then put your email on here so I can send you a copy, and you can make sure that there aren't any glaring inaccuracies. I made the mistake when I was first fetching interviews. I made the mistake of telling one gal to change it, you know, to go ahead and make changes,
mm-hmm.
Wherever she saw fit, and she rewrote the whole thing. It was just awful. And she had a really poignant story. She was an innkeeper in Cordova. And hers was a very unique story. So now I have to wait until the time is just right and go to her home in Anchorage and get down on bended knee and beg her to let us keep the original story. But I will do it.
I really get frustrated with the... I hope I'm never labeled as a... self-righteous environmentalist. And sometimes I think that industry looks at everybody on the RCAC as being that, or a lot of us. And ecology, we use just as much oil as the next guy, you know, and so just gotta be, just do the best we can.
Well, if anybody calls you a self-righteous ecologist, I'll stick up
for environmentalist, yes. I think
yes.
We're dealing with an issue right now.
on our little lake that we live on, Island Lake, about